called dark matter, which was recently found out by Selyakovic and Hirata, and see what it affects, how it affects the 21 centimeter fluctuations from the dark ages. Before going on to the talk, I just want to emphasize what I mean by the dark ages here. I mean redshifts greater than 30 or so. I mean before the formation of any stars or any luminous object, while the universe is still extremely well described by perturbation theory. So the overdensities are still smaller than unity, and we can use perturbation theory. We don't have to worry about any simulations or any sort of complications like this. So I don't need to convince, I think, the assistants, the audience, that Planck has, and or many other CMB experiments have taught us a lot about the universe. But also, I don't need to convince you that there are still many things to be learned about cosmology. So the CMB, even though it probes a sort of integrated information, it probes the standard cosmological model in an integrated way, physically it mostly probes a thin shell around redshift of 1100. Large-scale structure limits us to probing redshifts around, below or around unity or a few at most. Now, the 21 centimeter fluctuations can potentially probe redshifts all the way to about 200. The reason that it stops at 200, it doesn't go all the way to the surface of last scattering, is that beyond 200, the matter and the gas and CMB temperature are extremely well coupled, so there's basically no contrast. Everything is in complete equilibrium at the temperature of the CMB. So this opens up a very large time range, a redshift range, during which one could potentially probe variations to the expansion history or to the thermal history, such as, for example, heating by some dark matter annihilations or decay. You could, if you're into this, probe the change of fundamental constants or things like this. So this is the time frontier. The 21 centimeter fluctuations also open up observations to a whole new range of scales. So this was first pointed out by this paper by Loeb and Zaldarriaga, 2004. So this is here a plot of the angular power spectrum of 21 centimeter intensity fluctuations as they computed in this paper. So the CMB fluctuations are limited to small scales by silk damping, by the fact that photons diffuse a finite length around last scattering. And this limits you to wave numbers which are smaller than about 0.1 or 0.2 inverse megaparsecs. Beyond this, you simply have no power because photons diffuse on these scales. Large-scale structure is limited on scales larger than about, well, so k smaller than about 0.1 inverse megaparsecs as well, though it's for a very different reason. Here, the reason is not that there's no power. On the opposite, there's a lot of power on these very small scales. The reason that limits us is that it's hard to get a theoretical prediction because we are deeply in the nonlinear regime. So smaller scales are difficult to use. On the other hand, 21 centimeter fluctuations are in principle, and I insist on the in principle, available all the way to the gene scales, the gene scale of the baryon post recombination. This corresponds to wave number k of about 300 inverse megaparsecs. So this gives you a much bigger lever arm to probe this two or three orders of magnitude more of scales here. And in principle, you could learn a lot about inflations. You could test. Measure more precisely the tilt and the running of the primordial power spectrum. You can learn about warm dark matter, which would cause steep loss of power at small scales because of free streaming. You could learn about massive neutrinos. It's basically the same effect as the warm dark matter, except that they constitute a fraction of the dark matter. Non-velocities because you have much more scales, et cetera, et cetera. So this is the motivation why 21 centimeter is very interesting. Now, you probably heard that it's also a very, very challenging observation, which is why it hasn't been made yet. So first of all, there are some very basic observational difficulties, which is that the Earth atmosphere is transparent in the optical, it's transparent in the radio, but not at all radio wavelengths. You cannot go to arbitrarily low wavelengths, low frequencies, sorry. Beyond this, you have you reach the plasma frequency, and the atmosphere becomes opaque again. So frequencies lower than 10 megahertz correspond to redshifts greater than 140 or so. And so beyond this, you cannot observe anything from the Earth. So you have to think about going to space. So some people have suggested putting antennas on the moon, for example. Second problem is the foregon emission from the galaxy, synchrotron emission, is steeply increasing at high frequencies. And so you have to understand the foregons extremely well. So I'm not going to worry about those. These are problems that have to be overcome in any case. A third problem, so in the Loeb and Zadariega paper, and this paper, which is the current state of the art by Lewis and Chaloner, they compute the angular fluctuations up to multiple moments. I don't know if you can see on this plot, but this is L of a million, and this is L of 10 million. So this corresponds to a really, really tiny scale. So this is about a degree, and this is about one arc second, et cetera, et cetera. So if you ask what is the wavelength of 21 centimeter radiation at redshift 50, it's 10 meters. Now try and observe a 10 meter wavelength with an arc second resolution is extremely difficult. So you need an array, an antenna separation of about 1 kilometer to observe 10 meter wavelength with 1 degree angular resolution. So basically at multiple moments of 10 to the 4, you need an antenna separation of 100 kilometers. And a few times, a few hundred thousand, you need basically to cover the surface of the moon. You need to use the whole diameter of the moon if you wanted to observe such small fluctuations. So for our intents and purposes, these are very nice plots, but in practice, measuring anisotropies on these very tiny scales, L greater than 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5, which corresponds to wave numbers k of 1 or 10 inverse megaparsecs, is rather undoable in practice.
Is that true? I mean, people, so the diameter of the moon is less than the diameter of the Earth. People think the low far should be getting somewhere near that. So why do you say, why are you so pessimistic about getting those?
Well, so, I mean, I guess you could put cover the moon. I mean, you could put antennas on the moon, yeah, but it seems you do have to go to the moon.
Do 30 megahertz. Lofar will do that. Lofar has optimal Earth-sized basins.
Lofar is going to do 30 megahertz. So it's like
well, they get all 50? The way down. They get all the way down the atmosphere, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, I wouldn't be so pessimistic. You know, people do Earth-sized interferometry all the time.
Okay. Well, so that is more optimistic. But I was pessimistic just to show that the effect I'm going to talk about is interesting. I was pessimistic just to show you that there's actually an effect, as I'm going to discuss right now, that basically takes back the small scale power back into large scales. So, but yeah, if you're extremely optimistic, of course you could observe everything. Also, what I didn't mention, I'm just showing here the angular power spectrum, but of course 21 centimeters is a three-dimensional information. So even if you don't have a very nice angular resolution, you could try and observe in frequency bins, so information along the line of sight. But this would require, again, a very tiny frequency bin size. And I'm not familiar with radio instruments to tell you how feasible this is. So the bottom line of this talk, so we're, as I said, we are accounting, and I'm going to get to this in great detail, for the relative velocity of baryons in cold dark matter on the 21 centimeter signal. You'll see two effects. First of all, a decrease of the small scale power spectrum. And this is a decrease of order unity. So even as an academic exercise, it's an important effect, even though if you keep being pessimistic as I was, it's probably not going to be measurable anytime soon. The second and more important effect is that we find an enhancement of the large-scale power spectrum on scales which are, you know, measurable in principle without going all the way to the diameter of the moon. And this enhancement depends on the amount of power that you have on small scales. So this effect, and it's an effect that is present in the standard universe. It's not a supposition or something. It's really here in the standard universe. All right, so let me now, that Kendrick is here, get into the meat of the talk. So let me first summarize a few basic facts about the 21 centimeter transition. So this is the transition in the, between the two hyperfine states of the ground state of hydrogen. The energy splitting is about 6 micro electron volts, corresponds to 68 millikelvin. Note right away that this temperature is much smaller than any temperature in the universe at any time. So this will be useful to make some approximations. Frequency is 1420 megahertz in the rest frame. Wavelength is 21.1 centimeter. And the lifetime of the metastable state in vacuum is 11 million years. So the transition is very slow, but of course, because you have a lot of hydrogen, it's observable in a cosmological context. So I'm going to go through a few basic quantities which are used in the literature. So people use the spin temperature as a characteristic of the level population in the excited state versus the ground state. So it's basically the temperature that would characterize a Boltzmann distribution for these two states. So what determines this temperature? It's a balance between photon emission and absorptions, which tend to set the spin temperature to the CMB temperature. The bath with which they interact here is the CMB photons. And there's also a balance with collisions, essentially with neutral hydrogen atoms, because the universe is mostly neutral at the time. And these collisions tend to set the spin temperature to the gas temperature, which is slightly lower than the CMB temperature, because the adiabatic cooling is more efficient. So if you write down the steady state equation for the two levels, you can solve for the spin temperature as some function of the gas temperature, CMB temperature, and the local density of hydrogen. Okay, you don't have to remember this formula. It's just saying there's a way to get the spin temperature somewhere between gas and CMB temperature. Very basic radiative transfer. If you have a cloud of absorbing material with some characteristic temperature TS, the temperature characterizes the transition, not the kinetic temperature of the absorbers, but the transition, and some optical depth tau, you have a background source which has some characteristic temperature. Here, the background source is the CMB. And you ask, what is the characteristic temperature of the light after it goes through absorption? In the limit that the optical depth is much smaller than unity, and in the Rayleigh-Jeans limit, which is that the energy of the transition is much smaller than any of the temperatures of interest, you get this very simple formula, which is that the difference between the out temperature and the in temperature, the CMB, so this is what is usually called the brightness temperature, is just the optical depth times the difference between spin temperature and CMB. Okay, so typically in the dark ages, this number is negative. So the brightness temperature is really a negative brightness. And finally, the optical depth. So this might be basic for everyone. I just want to make a point at the end of all this. So the optical depth is just the integral of number of absorbers, cross-section along the line of sight. In a cosmological context, of course, the photons redshift along the line of sight. So the dl is just related to the redshifting, the d nu over h nu. Then you can just carry on the integral, and this is a frequency-dependent cross-section. The Hubble rate here should be replaced by the local expansion rate. So if the gas has a peculiar velocity divergence, it just acts as a local Hubble rate. So you have to put this full effective Hubble rate in this equation here. The cross-section is proportional to the Einstein A coefficient and has some profile, which we're going to approximate as a delta function. And finally, the number of absorbers that you plug in here is the number of true absorbers in the ground state minus the number of stimulated emitters, which is basically a negative absorption. And so in the limit that the spin temperature is much larger than the energy spacing, this gives you is proportional to the density divided by the spin temperature. So the bottom line is that the optical depth is some function proportional to the density of absorbers, obviously, over the local Hubble rate, which has some peculiar velocity, and divided by the spin temperature. So all these reminders, just to get to the bottom line, which is that the brightness temperature is, in the end, some complicated, not too complicated, but is some nonlinear function of the number density of hydrogen, the gas temperature, and the peculiar velocity. Okay, and it's a very generic function. Now, what is done in all previous literatures, just to say that during the dark ages, all the fluctuations of the density and the temperature are small, so we can expand all these expressions in small perturbations around the background values. And then you get basically a linear relationship between the fluctuations of the brightness temperature and the underlying fluctuations of the baryon over density, velocity, and gas temperature. So we have some sort of linear transfer function from what we want to get to, which is the over density, to the spin temperature. Now, I'll get back to this later, but the fact that this function is fundamentally a nonlinear function will be very important for the second part of this talk. So let me now completely switch topics. So this was a just recap on 21 centimeter and talk about this relative velocity effect. At the end, I'm going to stitch the two together. So this is, if you haven't read this paper, in my opinion, it's a really cool paper, and it's a very important effect. It's an effect in standard cosmology that had not been uncovered before. Chris is my advisor, that's why also I advertise his work. So the basic idea is that up to recombination, baryons are tightly coupled with the photons. So photons give them pressure, and so instead of collapsing under gravity, they just undergo acoustic oscillations. Meanwhile, the cold dark matter is completely oblivious to whatever baryons do and whatever photons do. It just grows, the perturbations of CDM grow under their own gravity. So they go a little slower than if the baryons were here to help, but they still grow quite steadily, basically as the scale factor to the 0.9 power instead of just proportional to the scale factor. After recombination, if we look at scales which are larger than the new gene scale, so prior to recombination, the gene scale was almost the horizon size. After recombination, the new gene scale is about k of 300 inverse megaparsecs. So for all scales larger than the gene scales, the baryons and the CDM basically behave like cold dark matter. They're going to start growing together under their mutual gravity. However, they start with very different initial conditions just at recombination. Okay, they have very different densities, over densities. The CDM over density is typically two orders of magnitude larger than that of the baryons, and they also have very different velocities. So this is, as a function of wave number, the transfer function normalized times, so times the square root of the primordial fluctuation. So basically, this is the characteristic velocity of each one of these fluids as a function of wave number. So this is extracted from cosmological code CAMP. So let me point out a few scales here. So first of all, this scale here, k of a few times 10 to minus 3 inverse megaparsecs, is the sound horizon just before recombination. So when the photons, the baryons still benefited from this pressure of the photons. So for scales which are larger than this, so smaller k, the CDM and the baryons are basically oblivious to photons. They have exactly the same transfer function, hence the same velocity. Hence, there's basically no power. There's no relative velocity. This scale here, the peak of the CDM velocity transfer function is k equality. It's the wave number that entered the horizon at matter radiation equality. So for smaller scales, the modes enter the horizon in radiation domination, and for larger scales, they enter the horizon in matter domination. They have a different growth rate. So in the transfer function for the baryon density, it translates to a logarithmic part. And once you divide by k to get the velocity, you have this basically log k over k decrease here. So this is why you have some peak here.
Could be a stupid question, but what do you mean by the CDM velocity? Because isn't that like a gauge choice? Like,
yes.
In a synchronous gauge where the CDM
So I guess, yes, that's a very good point. So this is completely gauge dependent. I think this is in synchronous gauge, but for all the scales which are larger than the horizon, there is a gauge dependence. For scales which are smaller, it's basically. So it is true that on these scales, this is a gauge dependent property. However, the relative velocity is actually independent. So, and this is what matters for me. So no, it was not a stupid question. Here on the baryon transfer function, so you see the acoustic oscillations of the baryons, which are damped for wave numbers which are larger than the silk damping scale. Again, which I mentioned before, photon diffusion damps completely all the oscillations, all the perturbations. And so for these scales, the relative velocity just snugs the curve of the cold dark matter velocity. So if you square that red curve, you get the power spectrum of the relative velocity, which is gauge independent. This curve is in the Tiliakovich and Hirata paper. And you see, so first of all, the characteristic magnitude at recombination is about 30 kilometers per second. Some features to see in this plot. First of all, you see that for k greater than a few tenths of inverse megaparsecs, there is basically no power in the relative velocity. So it means that on a commoving, a patch of a few commoving megaparsec scale, the relative velocity is very nearly uniform. First thing to notice, and two, that the fluctuations of the relative velocity are maximal around in this regime. So k of a, so in terms of physics of x, you know, of scale, it's a few tens to a few hundreds of megaparsecs, typically the BAO scale. So what does this relative velocity do? So if we have no relative velocity, let's just this is all linear theory, so we can consider Fourier modes independently. Let's take a CDM Fourier mode and a variant Fourier mode. They start with different amplitudes at recombination. And as they evolve, they grow together in harmony to bigger overdensities. Now, if we have a relative velocity between the two, so this relative velocity will advect baryonic perturbations across CDM perturbations, seen from the CDM point of view, or vice versa. So if you look at scales which are smaller than the characteristic, if you look at wavelengths which are smaller than the characteristic scale that the relative velocity advects one fluid with respect to another during a Hubble time, then what happens is that, say, seen from the baryons, the CDM at any given point, you're going to see some integrated plus, minus, gravitational potential from the cold dark matter. So the net effects will cancel out. Same thing from the CDM point of view. So with relative velocities, the baryons just grow under their own gravity, and so does the CDM. So this leads to a slower growth of structure. The scale of suppression, as I mentioned, is the characteristic corresponds to the inverse of the characteristic distance that can be traveled during Hubble time by this advecting velocity. It corresponds to x, a distance of a few tens of kiloparsecs, and k, wave number of about 40 inverse megaparsecs. This, notice, that is much a wave number which is much larger, so a scale which is much smaller than the coherent scale of the relative velocity. So we're going to follow Tsvetaeva and Hirata and use moving background perturbation theory, meaning that you can take a box which has a few megaparsecs across, assume that the relative velocity here is fixed, take it as a background, and you can evolve the small-scale perturbations with this given background relative velocity. This scale is larger than the gene scale, not by much, but by a factor of a few. Okay, this is because the sound speed is about 6 kilometers per second, just after recombination, whereas this velocity is about 30 kilometers per second. So the reason that this matters, so people always get all flustered about the supersonic part in it. There's no shocks or anything. It doesn't matter that it's supersonic. The reason it matters that it's supersonic is that if the scale was much smaller than the gene scale, then baryonic fluctuations would be suppressed in any case. So it wouldn't have any effect. In this case, this has an effect on, this suppresses growth of structure on scales which were not otherwise suppressed simply by baryonic pressure. And finally, why has this not been seen before is that the effect is fundamentally nonlinear. So in the continuity equation, this corresponds to this advection term, where here v is the relative velocity that you take as some locally homogeneous term. And so this, you see, is fundamentally a nonlinear term.
You said you don't form shocks?
Well, you don't form shocks at redshift 30. You do form shocks eventually, yes. People have run simulations, and of course you eventually run shocks. Because it's not instantaneous. So, yeah, you don't form a shock instantaneously.
Sure.
If you have a very tiny fluctuation, which we have at high redshifts, then the shock will grow slowly.
I think so. I would expect it to grow faster than it would if we didn't have supersonic velocity.
Yeah, so actually I'm going to mention that at some point. So yeah, there's two counterintuitive things. Is that one, what I described is that you expect perturbations to grow slower because of the advection. But on the other hand, you'll see that on some scales, perturbations grow faster. Okay, so how do we compute things? This is just a little technical slide, not super technical, but just to give you some details. So basically, you just solve for the fluid equations and say you go to the baryon rest frame and you just add in the continuity and the momentum equation an advection term. Okay, that's all there is to it. This is the baryon momentum equation, and here notice that there's a, so this is just the pressure term. So P is proportional to density times temperature, so if you perturb it correctly, you also have fluctuation of the gas temperature. So this system is not complete yet, so we need some equation for the gas fluctuations. Gas fluctuation, again, extremely basic physics. You just perturb the first law of thermodynamics. Okay, so this gives you some equation for the evolution of the gas temperature. Note here that I'm just accounting for the Compton heating of the gas by CMB photons, which has this form, so basically proportional to the difference between CMB temperature and gas temperature. But we could a priori, and we will do so in future work, include some extra heating terms, such as if you have dark matter annihilation or decay, for example. And you perturb this equation, and again here you see that because of the Compton heating depends on the local free electron fraction, you also have to account consistently for the free electron fraction perturbations. So how do you do this? You just start with the recombination rates of the, so the dxe dt. So this is, by the way, the fraction of free electrons to total hydrogen atom. And after the last scattering surface, you can neglect the photoionization term because the abundance of free electrons is way higher than psi equilibrium. So what you just have is the recombination coefficient. And this one, by the way, I talked about this here 3 years ago, is an exact recombination coefficient that accounts for all the excited states of hydrogen. And this is the Peebles C factor, which accounts for the fact that once you reach an excited state, you have some probability of being photoionized before reaching the ground state. So anyway, this is just basic recombination physics, which you perturb, and finally you get an equation. You have a closed system of equations for the baryon overdensity and velocity, cold dark matter, gas temperature, and free electron fraction. So we're doing exactly what codes like CAM do on small scales. Notice that all my equations were purely Newtonian because I'm looking at scales which are much, much smaller than the horizon size. The only difference here is that we're solving for basically the transfer functions of all these quantities as a function not only of wave number, but also as a function of the local value of the relative velocity, which, as I said before, can be assumed to be a locally uniform field because we're looking at scales much smaller than the scales over which this fluctuates. So what does this do to the small scales? So here, as a function of redshift, I'm showing either the real part or the absolute value of the baryon over density. I divide this by the scale factor to take away the most of the growth during matter domination. So if you have no relative velocity, this is this dashed curve here, you just see some steady growth. Now, if you add some relative velocity, if I look at the real part, what you see is some sort of acoustic oscillation. So this relative velocity acts like some sort of turbulent pressure. Okay? And what it does on the absolute value of delta is just to decrease it, and you can see that the decrease is significant. It's not a, you know, a small correction, it's an order one correction. And this wave number is, by the way, a scale which is larger than the Jean scale. Now, something we realized that was not pointed out in Chris's paper, which is kind of a neat effect, but I don't know if it has any implications. So if someone comes up with one, please come and tell me. So if you look at very, very small scales, so scales which are deep in the sub-Jeans regime, so in which the, if you look at the baryons, basically, they're like a driven oscillator. So the driving force is the cold dark matter. And then you have pressure, and it's also a damped oscillator because of the Hubble expansion. So this is the evolution of the overdensity without relative velocity. So you see here, basically, baryon acoustic oscillations. Under the, so these are just sound waves. Now, if you add some relative velocity, you see at first, again, oscillations which are due to this turbulent pressure and have a higher frequency. However, the relative velocity decreases as 1 over the scale factor, whereas the sound speed at early times decreases as 1 over square root of the scale factor. So eventually, the frequency of these oscillations due to the relative velocity and those due to the sounds, to the pressure, become comparable. And essentially, you have, at that point, some resonant pumping of the acoustic waves of baryons. So the relative velocity for very, very small scales actually increases the baryon over densities. And so eventually, this would turn into shocks. So just to illustrate here, as a function of redshift, I'm showing in dashed the adiabatic sound speed. And in the solid line is the relative velocity, 1 sigma per axis. So it's 30 kilometers per second divided by root 3. It starts at 17 kilometers per second. And you see that at late times, there's this cosmic coincidence that they are very similar to one another. Well, I mean, this is just the relative velocity has, of course, it's distributed, right? It's all distribution. I'm just showing the 1 sigma here. This is the 1 sigma, yeah. You seemed perplexed. So small scale power spectrum, that's the first result on small scales. Baryon over density in black, gas fluctuations in blue, no relative velocity in dashed with a relative velocity. So this is all redshift 50. And you see here. This goes as 1 over a, this goes as 1 over square root of a, and then I was 1 over a. Exactly, yeah. Because the gas temperature goes as 1 over a square and then 1 over a. So opposite, 1 over a and then 1 over a square. So yeah, you see here that you have a suppression of the fluctuation by order 50% or so at k of about a few hundred inverse megaparsec. Same for the gas temperature, except that notice the enhancement at small scales is more important. That's a detail. I try and give you some more intuitive explanation later if you're interested in this. Once you convert these into 21 centimeter angular power spectrum, redshift 120 and 50, you see again that the main effect is this decrease around multiple moment of a few millions of the angular fluctuations, and this decrease is of order unity. Like 50% or so. Okay, so this is an order unity effect. I'm using here, just for reference, a window function of 0.1 megahertz. All right. However, notice that these scales are, again, extremely small. So if you were to measure these, again, it's with a telescope on the moon, etc. Not completely undoable, but rather difficult. OK, now I'm going to move on to the part which I think is more interesting, which is the effect on the large-scale signal. And this is slightly less intuitive. So again, I recall that what we want to measure is the brightness temperature, which is some function which is nonlinear of the local density, gas temperature, and the local velocity gradient. So the spin temperature itself depends on the density and the gas temperature, etc. So we're expanding it to first order in the deltas, but really you could expand it to any order you want, and these coefficients will be comparable. Now you may say, okay, this is the dark ages. The whole point of going to the dark ages is that I can do some simple calculations because all the densities are small. Right, but delta is a function of scale. It's not a uniform quantity. So there is a different amplitude in delta on large scales and small scales. So here I'm showing, for example, this is a redshift 50, the characteristic baryon over density. So this is the square root of the power per log k. Versus, so first of all, what you see here is that the overdensity on small scales is much larger than the overdensity on large scales. Okay, if my small scales are k of 100 or so, where the relative velocity has any effect, and my large scales are k of 0.01 to 0.1, where the relative velocity fluctuates, then you see that there's a difference between the two. If I square this quantity, you see actually that delta squared on small scales is comparable to just delta on large scales. So in this expansion, just wrote this. So in this expansion, really, if I want to be consistent, I want to include the delta large scale to linear order, but the delta small scale to quadratic order, if I want to be consistent. In particular, if I want to look at the long wavelength, so if I look at the short wavelength, I'm going to get a delta small plus a delta small squared, but this is going to be smaller than this because it's a small quantity. But if I look at the long wavelength fluctuations, I get this. This gives me delta long, and this gives me delta short squared, comma long. So this is the long wavelength fluctuation of the square of the short wavelength fluctuations. So if there were no relative velocity, this term actually would be very small. So the delta squared long, delta squared long would be basically of the order of delta long squared, roughly speaking. It's not exact, but it's something of that order. But now with the relative velocity, this term actually becomes important. So pictorially, heuristically, how does that work? Take a long wavelength mode of the relative velocity. So it fluctuates on the scales typically of 100 megaparsecs or so. Now let's look at the small scale fluctuations of the baryon over density. So these small scales are really separated by two or three orders of magnitude or more from this long wavelength fluctuations. So locally, the small scale power spectrum is modulated by the value of the relative velocity. So if you have a zero relative velocity, you get the standard picture with the, you know, the standard small scale power spectrum. And if you have a large positive or negative relative velocity, you have a suppression by order 50% or so of the small scale power spectrum. Now you just take the square of this quantity, you average the small scale modes over, you average over the small scale modes, and you are left with a long wavelength fluctuation of delta short squared, which again would not be present, or would just be some stochastic thing, much smaller, if there was not this relative velocity effect. Okay, and again, because I don't know why I just added this. I'm just repeating it anyway. All right. Just a side technical side note. So I'm going to show you some power spectra of delta squared. Right. So there's the power spectrum of delta and the power spectrum of delta squared. So how do we compute this? So if you want to compute the large scale fluctuation of delta short squared, because of the separation of scales, you can between the large wavelength fluctuations of relative velocity and again the small scales on which it has an effect, we can first take an average over, say, a spatial average of delta short squared over some window function which has an intermediate size. And second, because this window function is much larger than the small wavelengths we're looking at, we can replace this window function average by a statistical average. So delta short squared on long wavelength is basically the integral of the power spectrum, P of k, which is a function of the local relative velocity. So this is a kind of weird function because it depends on Fourier modes and also on VBC, which is a function of position. But the reason is that this is a small scale k, and the VBC can be considered as homogeneous there. So then we can compute the correlation function, which is just, so we have this function to from which we subtract the mean, of course. And as a function, it depends on VBC, we correlate it with the same function at VBC of x plus x prime. And to compute this average, you just need the six-dimensional probability distribution of two relative velocities. So that was probably the computationally more annoying part of the problem, to do these integrals in the most efficient way. So here, just to illustrate, I'm showing at redshift 60 and 30, the power spectrum, so the power per log k, really, of the baryon density and of the baryon density squared. And you see that at large scales, they become comparable. And even around the baryon acoustic scale here, the wiggles here, they are between 10% and 1%. So these fluctuations are between 1 and 10% of the power spectrum of delta. OK, so now how do we get the 21 centimeter fluctuations? We expand the brightness temperature to second order in all of these fluctuations. Now you may ask, why isn't there a second order term in the velocity? So this is just the velocity gradient. It's because redshift space distortions actually have exactly compensate the quadratic terms. I can show that later if you are interested. Note also that the gas temperature here should also be expanded to second order. So if you even look at just the adiabatic expansion, so if T gas proportional to the density to the 2/3, this is not a linear function. So you have quadratic terms, et cetera. If you want to do things properly, you just have to expand this equation to second order. And so the gas temperature fluctuation has some linear part, which I computed before, plus a quadratic part, which we put in here. This is just to illustrate the characteristic magnitude of all of these terms. So this quadratic part to the, so this large scale quadratic part to the 21 centimeter intensity fluctuation has a magnitude of typically 0.1 millikelvin. And so it's composed of all these different terms, the gas temperature squared, baryon squared, the second order gas temperature fluctuation, and the cross terms, okay? And it has this very annoying property that it nearly cancels at this redshift. So it could have been much bigger, but it turns out that it's actually peaking at rather low redshifts, redshift 30 or so, which makes it annoying because at that time, basically, it's when you start worrying about things becoming nonlinear, so first stars and things like this. So this is the power spectrum of 21 centimeter fluctuation. So this dashed lines are the standard terms without the velocity term because it has some different dependence. And these solid lines are additional terms. And you see that before redshift 30, they're quite lower. But at redshift 30, they become 10% or so, typically around k of 0.05, 10 to 1%. Now, if you convolve this with the spherical Bessel function to get the angular power spectrum, because the standard term. That's the quadratic term in the brightness temperature fluctuation.
So you have to add together the. So
yeah, they're additive. The reason they're additive is, yeah, there's no cross correlation. Yeah, it's actually smaller. This is like 10%, right? And this is 1%. It's smaller, but it's, you know. So, you know, this is what people call it in the literature, I think. Because if you write, delta TB, there's some term which doesn't depend on the local line of sight, plus there's a term which depends on the line of sight, the line of sight gradient of the velocity. So in a sense, this is some sort of quadrupole, if you want. Yeah, the monopole is the one that depends only on the baryon density and the baryon temperature. So there's also this term, but you can't plot it in the same plot, I guess, because it depends on the orientation of. I mean, you could average it over orientation or something.
Is that big or how?
No, it's not so big. So in the first paper that Loeb and Zadariaga wrote, they only considered this term actually, not even the gas temperature. So it is formally of the same order. But it's not super big. It's not a factor of two or something. I don't know, it's several percent or tens of percent.
Is that like redshift
space
distortion? Sorry?
So I think it's completely different, and I can discuss this if you want. But people call it redshift space distortion. And the reason is that the term of redshift space distortion has the same shape. And this is why. Actually, the quadratic term is physically completely different. As I explained, this term here comes from the fact that the local expansion rate is Hubble plus the gradient of the peculiar velocity. Yes, but this term that comes into the optical depth is really physically, it's not a distortion. It doesn't depend on the observer. It's at that point where the transition happens, there's a different velocity, and hence the escape probability is different. It doesn't depend on who is observing or what. But yeah, people call it redshift space distortion. I don't know why. OK, so yeah, because you're integrating over the power spectrum times some spherical Bessel function, this is an increasing function. So actually, you know, we also often say that at multiple moment L corresponds to wave number k r equal L. This is not actually true. It's a whole integral. And because the power spectrum raises steeply, fluctuations at some given angular scale, L, actually take in fluctuation power spectrum from smaller scales. Okay, so this is why when you look at the angular fluctuations, the terms that we computed don't look so big in comparison to the previous terms. So it's typically a few percent correction at large angular scales. This changes slightly when you change the window function, but it's never more. So this is the ratio of the correction to the previously existing term. It's never more than a few percent.
So this is all including this relative velocity effect. So how much difference does the relative velocity itself make? Because you're here considering the half a second order effect.
Yes. So there is. Can everyone see on the board? So you. That's right. So brightness temperature is some. This is the standard term, right? Plus this quadratic term. And I'm plotting them separately. So you may ask, if I take the autocorrelation of this, I should have some cross terms. Is that your question?
I was just wondering, is the CDR probably
So it affects this, term only on very, very small scales, but on these scales, it has absolutely no effect. I mean, this term here is not affected directly. There's an exactly. There's an effect on very, very small scale, which I discussed. Right? Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And this term is actually uncorrelated with this one. Okay. So yeah. So it's a small relative effect, but what I'm going to claim is that so this depends. I wrote the integral before, so you had delta short squared, which is basically the integral of the power spectrum. Right? And then you modulate this on large scales. So this addition depends on the small scale power spectrum. It depends directly on the small scale power spectrum. It depends on it in an integrated way. So of course, it's going to be hard to distinguish between different scenarios, but it has some information about the small scale power spectrum. And even though this is a small relative correction, you have many modes. And so this brings me to my conclusions. Yes.
The effect is suppressed by a lot. I mean, the experiments are by 3D to 2D production.
Yeah.
The experiments don't really need to do that. I think that's sort of what you do if you have worse radial resolution or angular resolution. But 10 to the centimeter experiments are generally the regime with radial resolution.
That's right.
Better than
yeah.
So the previous sort of possible case space, I think, show like this the
vulnerable side. Yeah. You mean you could just look at the radial line of sight?
Yeah,
that's a good point.
I mean,
yeah.
That's
true. That's true, yeah. Again, a more optimistic statement. So yeah, I was getting to my conclusions. So to summarize, what I've shown you is that this relative velocity effect, which again is completely, you know, it's a fact of the universe. It's not some supposition or something. It leads to a suppression of the power spectrum. Exactly. I'm assuming that there's baryons in dark matter. Exactly. And yeah. Yes. I'll get back to it. Anyway, so it suppresses power on small scales. And what's more interesting, it enhances it on large scale. With an enhancement which depends on the underlying small-scale power spectrum. Okay, so it brings back the small-scale physics to large angular scales, or large, not only angular, but also just large scale in the power spectrum of the 21 centimeter. So future work, well, this is just all words. Now, of course, we'll have to quantify this. So what's the signal to noise? If you measure, if you change the NS, neutrino mass, warm dark matter, etc., and something I've not thought much about, but happy to talk about it with the people who are more familiar with it, is how this interacts with non-Gaussianities. So can this prevent measurements of non-Gaussianities, or can it, on the other hand, enhance it? So something I would like to think about. That's it.
How does the enhancement depend on time, or is it?
Excuse me?
How does that relative enhancement compare to no consideration of losses? Is that time dependent? Or
yeah, it's completely time dependent, yeah. So
it goes away at later time?
This is what this plot was showing. So this is the dependence of the quadratic part on time. So at high edge, it's basically several terms cancel out, mm-hmm. turns out. And it really peaks at redshift 30 or so.
Okay.
So which also means, as I was mentioning, that so just basically what we did in this paper is adding a nonlinear term, but we're adding terms of order delta short squared of the delta, which is formally order one. But we're neglecting terms of order delta, say short squared over delta short, or things like this. However, at redshift 30, if you look at delta squared to the 1/2, it actually gets to a few tenths. It's like 0.1 or 0.2 or so. So really, even though formally this is a different term, if we really want to include all the terms properly now, because this peaks at rather low redshifts, we will have to account for also corrections of order delta square, etc. Yes.
One comment I had is that, I mean, you're presenting this second order term as something that's maybe not expected, but I mean, this is really maybe more familiar way of putting it is just bias, that this is, so the 20 mass centimeter or gas is a nonlinear tracer of matterless distribution, so you can think of it as a bias tracer, and basically all you're doing, you're calculating the bias. And I think you can probably go to all orders, you don't have to do it. Something like a Schechter formalism, basically. Yeah.
Well, but it's quite different because it's not. We're not talking about collapsed objects here, right?
But no. But basically, the press Schechter, the idea is that there is a. You have a peak background separation, basically.
Yeah.
And of course, press Schechter is you integrate over Gaussian. Here, I guess, what I'm thinking is, you have a background relative velocity. And then you want to see, and that background relative velocity could be very big, I suppose. And then you want to see how much it changes the.
But I agree that in principle, maybe you could, because we have some analytic formula for 21 centimeters as a function of the over density. And the over density, you can assume it's a Gaussian, even though at late times it's not anymore, but you can assume this. So in principle, maybe it is computable to arbitrary.
Yeah, okay. So I guess I'm not quite sure that this exact same thing can be done. Because my point is that this is actually very similar to this non-local bias that people were talking about, like Dalal and company. Because, I mean, there it was the potential that was modular thinking, here is the velocity that's not modular thinking.
Yeah.
But I guess the non-linear thing that's happening in this case but collapsed, maybe that here it's not quite the same thing, so
And also in the case of the, so we're talking about the non-Gaussian bias, I guess.
Yeah.
So in that case, it's a more simple expression because you really have 1 plus 5, right? 1 plus FNL times 5.
Right.
Whereas here, the relative velocity lives inside the bar expression. So it's slightly more complicated in that sense.
No, I don't see the difference, actually. So here you have V instead of 5, so that's...
Yeah, but what I mean is that you don't have just... the effect is not just some 1 plus 5 multiplication, some slight...
No, but you know, even there, there's a transfer function that goes there. It's not just 1 plus 5.
Okay.
So both of them have a transfer function.
I see.
But the difference here is velocity, there is 5. So I think it's a little bit intermediate in scale as opposed to... Right. And I guess the other thing I was wondering is, have you thought about later time, like could galaxy distribution be biased? Display. So you're here talking about high redshift, but I guess
dwarf
galaxies and things
like
that.
I know there's been some work on like Jovovic or working at the IS. They worked on the suppression of the satellites, the missing satellites.
But here you have even enhancement, not just suppression.
Yeah, so I'm not sure. If
you read that right, on large scales, it's sort of going away at low redshift, or is that the wrong interpretation?
Yeah.
It's going away.
It's kind of dying, right?
Yeah, but this is special for 21 centimeters. So if we're talking now about formation of galaxies, we don't know how this behaves.
Could you comment a little more on what you think would happen with neutrinos or warm dark matter when you've got the dark matter having its own, its own more complicated velocity and sound speeds and things going on?
It's more complicated velocity.
So you mentioned at the end, effects of massive neutrinos or warm dark matter.
Yes.
What were you thinking of that?
I was thinking something rather simple. Just okay. I was just thinking that. So this is the dark matter. Well, no, this is not dark matter, but it could be the dark matter power spectrum without the cusp here. And so the dark matter power spectrum would be suppressed if you have neutrinos, and hence the baryon also would be suppressed.
And would that make, how would that affect these relative velocities? Would that make that,
so it's
make
not
that harder to observe because it's changing the small scale power away from what you think it would be?
Yeah, so the relative velocity will not be affected because it has support on much larger scales, which are very well measurable already.
Okay.
But this function here, the integral, the average of the small scale power will be smaller. So basically, if you completely suppress the small-scale power because of neutrinos or warm dark matter, you will not have this enhancement that I talked about.
Right. So like in this MKI 1KEV thing, that's killed your small scale power, so your small scale power can't now move to large scale.
Exactly, so you would see a difference. Exactly, but so then you can measure
the
difference.
So you can use the large scales to tell you something about the small scales.
Exactly.
And it would be different if your small scale power is different.
Exactly. So if it's zero, then you have no enhancement, but if you also have some crazy enhancement of small scale, some very blue spectrum or something, you could, in principle, see more enhancement.
Okay, I guess we'll stop there and we'll thank Yassine again. But before we do, we will be going to dinner in the bistro with Yassine. As usual, everyone's invited. Postdocs and students will be catered for, and then we'll be eating about 6 in the bistro. So just come along if you want to go. And Yassine's going to be here all day today and all day tomorrow. So do go and email him and speak to him if you want to. So thank you again.